everyone. Welcome back to Planners Under the Influence, the podcast about becoming urban planners. I'm Heather.
And I am Diego.
And welcome back.
Welcome back, and it's happy to record again together, right?
Yeah, this is the first time we're recording in person together in...
what?
Months.
Yeah, it's been some long months.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to be back to this, and I think we are really, really excited about the episode that we have for you.
Yeah, while Diego and I are in person at the moment, this one was would have had to be over Zoom even without COVID, because he's our first international guest.
Yeah, besides that excitement about contacting and sharing the stories from someone from another part of the world, it was just pretty interesting to see, to have some perspectives and to share with everyone that is listening how in urban planning you can actually have a really, really cool job.
Yeah.
So
it's funny, I think when you finally decide like I'm gonna do urban planning, or urban planning sounds cool, you picture kind of what he does. Like, you don't picture approving permits or whatever, you picture like going out into the community and creating spaces that are vibrant and inclusive and bring people together, and he's kind of living the dream.
And I think that is exactly what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, we don't want to say too much about it, and I hope you guys listen to
it. Yeah, we'll let him speak for himself.
Yeah, he will speak for itself, but we encounter a lot of great terminologies.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was, again, my passion for urban planning, again, was sparked by...
Yeah, I would say this is an episode for anyone who's like... we have a lot of friends at the moment who are recent graduates, and it's a really, really hard time to be... looking for work, obviously, in planning, but in any industry. And I think this conversation for both of us was a reminder of like why we wanted to get into planning in the first place, and kind of what possibilities there are.
Yeah. Okay, well, we don't want to keep you listening to us again too much time. We want you to listen, and we want to welcome in this episode to Ramon Marrades. Welcome to Planners Under the Influence, the podcast where we discuss the journey about becoming urban planners. We can only say that it's a pleasure to have a urban economist as a guest, and we're very excited to talk to you about your backgrounds, your books, projects, and your columns, which we very much like. So welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great honor. I'm really excited to talk to you, and if possible, to convince much more people to become urban planner.
Exactly. You know, that's great. That's great. And I guess first and foremost, tell us a little bit more about how you evolved from an economist to a placemaker. Really.
Yeah. Actually, I studied economics because I wanted to understand the world, and that's a very big goal, never achieved, by the way. During my studies, I realized that I didn't like much the subdisciplines of economics that were much more mainstream, but at the same time, much more based on niche, like financial economics, macroeconomics, and so on.
Yeah.
And I really was enjoying not only gathering, but reading and learning from other disciplines and professions. I love architecture, culture, design, and so on. And I really wanted to hang out with the more artistic folks. So I think that was one of the reasons. I'm also a musician, so I've been playing in bands since I was 15, so very involved in the do-it-yourself culture, do-it-yourself venues, alternative music scene in my city. So I became really, really interested in the intersection between economics and culture And also, I've considered myself always a very urban person, so very interested, maybe at the beginning in a more, in a less clear way, no? But in cities in general, like buildings, streets, this kind of things. So I remember at one point in my bachelor, I got a fantastic lecturer, and he was a professor of urban economics, and he was the former chief of cabinet of the mayor of Valencia in the 80s. Great mayor, you know, some of the greatest things that happened in the city was because of his government. So he's kind of a strategic guy, like the guy that was strategizing the development of the city in the 80s. He was he was teaching me urban economics, and I thought, wow, that's my thing.
Yeah.
And I actually, like, when I finished the course, I went to talk to him, and he said, you know, why don't you work with me?
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And I started doing some research with him. And also, as I said, being connected with the creative community in the city. So that kind of actually made sense. And which is quite, like, I find it a bit funny, is that, I don't know, like, if I look it backwards, it makes much more sense that it, if when I was actually experience that moment.
Yeah.
No? So suddenly I guess, okay, I was doing economics, but I was just writing those lyrics in my punk band that were almost short essays of economics. So I don't know, like, I wasn't thinking about that. No, but this record that we launched, where the first track is called The Invisible Hand. But I was not really clear with that. But then I realized that it made sense. And actually that this do-it-yourself ethics was really inspired in a really deep way how I approach cities. And then obviously, like, in that course I discovered Jane Jacobs, and you know what's happened when you discover Jane Jacobs. It's suddenly this kind of this big stream of fresh air that that moves your hair and said, well, what's happening here? And then I realized that I wanted to do that. I still consider an economist, so I'm using the tools of economics to understand cities and to try to develop policies. But I'm also an action guy, so I really want to be in the place with my feet on the ground and see things happening. So that was actually the reason. So I started, I don't know, with 22, doing small research projects, but also was very involved in the city as an activist, trying to stop some big development projects that proven to be not that much successful. And at a certain point, I considered Valencia wasn't that fun to live in, so I moved to Barcelona, then to the Netherlands. And at a certain point, I decided to go back again, so I started my office in urban development with a colleague that he's an architect, and now he's the main advisor for urban issues to the mayor of Valencia. So
wow. It
seems that we did something well together, and now here I am, sitting in the office at the waterfront. I'm probably having had, during the last 4 years, one of the cooler jobs in town.
That's
actually
amazing.
Really good.
One of the things I love about urban planning, and something that I've, like, learned from doing this podcast, is that no one grows up wanting to be an urban planner. Everyone comes with some sort of different perspective, whether it's, like, training as an economist or an architect or in logistics like Diego, or as development, like international development like me, but everyone kind of comes with their unique perspective. And then as a result, the discipline just seems to be this kind of like scrapbook of, or mosaic of all these different experiences that kind of come together into urban planning, almost like the city itself. It's very cool.
That's really unique, actually. I didn't want to like point out in a specific profession, but imagine that, I don't know, you do business and you then decide to specialize in finance, and then you do your master in finance, and then you start to work in a bank, and you're working in finance with all those guys that work in finance. And luckily enough, you will have a fantastic life outside, but I really like to also be exposed to things that make me challenge my position and my thoughts. And that's what working around cities, what it allows to.
Yeah,
that's a great introduction about your journey. And now I'm curious about, you already mentioned about this connection with being a creative person. So I'm really interested about this you call yourself the creative bureaucrat. And I'm really interested to see how you apply this on your job work or on your activities, really.
Yeah, this is a bit of a provocative term.
Mm.
And actually the
that's how
the,
I like it. That's why I like it.
It almost seems like an oxymoron, but I trust that it's not.
It shouldn't be, no, but the thing actually it is a concept that was coined by Charles Landry. You probably know him. He's probably one of the more renowned urban intellectuals in Europe nowadays. And he came to Valencia to give a talk, and he mentioned the concept. And immediately there was a click on my head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only that I'm really interested to learn more, but suddenly I heard it was kind of similar to placemaking. No, I think to placemaking is to traditional urban development the same of creative, the same that creative bureaucracy is to red tape bureaucracy. But he said, oh, creative bureaucracy. Said, wow, that's that's interesting. And it's interesting in several ways. No, first of all, because it's a concept that is different to public sector innovation or government innovation, which are other kind of concepts that are widely used, because it's actually both empowering the individual, so it means that everyone can add value and being creative in within public sector from administrative task to the CEO, but everyone can be creative on the role. And at the same time, it's as well legitimating, no? Because you are, well, like we are well aware how public sector and public sector jobs are under threat because some specific interests, sometimes some ideology, but there are things around the stereotypes that we have around public sector that not really true. I don't know, it's proven. Mariana Mazzucato, which is very popular nowadays, but there are a lot of examples of public sector work that is not only necessary, but also helps us to advance as a society, and it's most of, sometimes it's even better than private sector, and now specifically in this COVID situation, we are seeing it. So thanks God we live, or the ones that we have the privilege to live in a society which public sector is strong enough to protect us in the specific times. So suddenly all those Keynesian people that seemed that they were like vanished now are coming back to the public debate, and it sounds that nobody is neoliberal anymore. But we'll see how it goes in the following months. But we are realizing that. So but basically, public sector is important. It has the capacity of innovate. There is a bunch of talent that sometimes is underused within public sector. Mm. We have to legitimate and empower. And also, it forces you to do things differently from the beginning. As soon as you challenge yourself, like, okay, I'm a creative bureaucracy, and I will tell you a kind of a fun story or joke. No, but imagine that you ring the phone and you're calling to the tax department. And then you hear like this pre-recorded answer, and they say, okay, if you want to talk to a civil servant, press 1. But if you want to talk to a creative bureaucrat, press 2. What would you do, no? And then, but it forced you to do things differently. And there are plenty of stories that Charles collected in his book. And from that, I said, okay, that's what I do on the one hand. But in the second hand, that's the only way to do what I was doing. That was the only way to do what I was doing, because I will tell you more later, but when we started working at the Waterfront Institution, it was financially in a very bad situation, but also socially as a space, it was underused. It was considered to be lacking any attractiveness. So it was important to be creative. And also being from Southern Europe, I'm really used to creativity. And it seems that now that we are in another crisis, I've been in a constant crisis since I finished my studies. So there is no alternative.
Mm.
So that was the thing. And I really like as well that it's somehow provocative, no?
Yeah.
So this first idea, is it an oxymoron? And then obviously it's not.
So I
consider that I try to apply within public sector and within the rules of public sector as much creativity as possible to do my work as better as possible.
I love that. I've been working in local government now for 6 months or so, and I think I've always resonated with local government because it's, you know, so connected with community, and there's so much that local government can do, but also been kind of wary because of that reputation of it being bureaucratic and boring and not very progressive. And I'm lucky to work for a very progressive local government that embraces creativity. But I think if we had more conversations about us all being creative bureaucrats, it would kind of open up the possibilities of what we could do in government.
Yeah, actually, like, it's like we can go for hours around that. But it's interesting, like, there are a lot of things that we could explore, no? But the one thing that is quite clear is within public sector employees, they are more, so there is higher degree of creative outside the workplace
right.
in public sector
work. Oh, interesting.
So public sector workers tend to be generally more progressive. They tend to enjoy cultural activities in cities.
Mm.
They tend to be creative themselves. So they are musicians, they are painters generally, you know, for the kind of, first of all, studies that it needs and for the kind of self-selection process, you know, which kind of people tend to become a civil servant. And at the same time, most of them are activists, so where they are really involved in the community. But it seems that most of them have a kind of Clark Kent and Superman syndrome. So they
totally.
Are Clark Kent at work, but then they went out of work, and suddenly they are like they are become Superman, and they are playing in a death metal band, or being super active at the association of parents at school, or they do urban gardening. So I think that there is a lot of potential. And that's linking to our recommendation. So there is a really cool former civil servant in Adelaide, Margie Gost.
Okay.
She co-authored the Creative Bureaucracy book with Charles Landry. I'm actually working with them in the global Creative Bureaucracy Initiative. And she started a really cool survey for civil servants, first in Australia, but there are some global responses. And she shows that results. Like,
that's
which is
so
this
cool.
creative potential that is underused within public sector employees.
That's amazing. That is really, really, truly remarkable. Speaking about like your experience, we now share a little bit of experience in terms of our professions. You're currently the Chief Strategy Officer at La Marina Valencia.
Mm-hmm.
Please, can you tell us a little bit more about the project and the vision behind it?
Yeah, La Marina Valencia is 100% public agency that is in charge of the redevelopment of the old harbor and the waterfront in Valencia.
Okay.
So we are basically a waterfront development agency, and we manage a space which is the old harbor plus new marinas plus new public space of around 1 million square meters, 20 buildings, 3 big marinas for 800 boats, 20 restaurants, business incubators, business school, and so on, which is on the one hand one of the most beloved public space in town, and on the second hand is the main innovation district in town. But that wasn't like that 4 years ago. So actually it's been a new strategy that we launched 4 years ago that actually created change. And it is curious because several years ago, as an activist, I was opposing the development of the waterfront
right.
as it was planned, and now I'm managing. So I'm managing it, which is kind of funny. But the thing is, the waterfront development in Valencia was one of the biggest examples of the failure of the development-led or infrastructure-led urban development in town. And basically what we did in Valencia was many other cities have done around the globe. We build infrastructure without thinking how to use that. So we transform the waterfront, like we create like those buildings, we did all the infrastructure investment, around 500 million euros. Then we like for hosting sport events. So we did America's Cup, by the way, Fremantle did in Australia. But in this case, like we organize America's Cup, then we host Formula One as Melbourne, we got for 5 years, and that was a financial disaster for the city, but it had to be paid at the end around another 500 million euros by taxpayers' money. And all those projects that should attract tourism, create wealth, and so on, actually created a financial a public financial disaster, like for taxpayers' money. It was of €1 billion approximately. But what was more worrisome, it's also created emotional distance.
Right.
So people in town wasn't interested in to go to the place at all. No, there were some expensive restaurants, some places for boats, but it was totally disconnected. And funny enough, when it was still closed as a commercial harbor, that it was in decay, no, because it was the inner harbor, it was small. But during the 90s, it was widely used for the local communities as a semi-public space. So people went there to maybe drink a beer, walk around, went fishing, they were even swimming. And the thing is, after investing so much money and after making it public, the impression was to it became more private.
Right, wow.
And it was totally underused. And when we started, so that's also, I cannot deny that it was related to politics.
Mm.
After this great mayor that I told you, we got a mayor for 25 years. She was very, very popular. Very popular, and she gave the impression that was creating a big amount of wealth for the city and its citizens, but it came with great cost. No, so the development style for the city for 23 years was to build big infrastructure, museums, congress halls, avenues, and so on, but without taking into account or without taking care of the urban tissue, lead, create a big gap between the wealthy city and the not that wealthy. They underinvest in several neighborhoods, and also they force the city to over specialize in tourism and real estate, and that also created a bigger damage after the financial crisis of 2008. So the Great Recession, so what much more damaging for Valencia than that for the rest of cities around Europe, more than the rest of the most of the cities around Europe. And then in 2015, there was a change of government, like in many other cities in Spain. You know, like cities in Spain are very, very powerful. So they have a lot of competences, and there is normally one municipality for the big core city, no?
Right.
Now, I know the case of Sydney, that Sydney municipality is really small. I guess in Melbourne it's the same, no?
Yeah.
But the city is just the city hall, managed like 1 million people. Like they have all the exclusive, they take care exclusively on urban planning, of mobility, and so on. So they are very important. So every big city in Spain suddenly, for some circumstances, was suddenly governed by a mayor that didn't belong to any of the traditional parties. And in the case of Valencia, well, the mayor was elected and he was backed by strange coalitions of the all left, green activists, environmental activists, neighborhood activists, LGBTQ activists. So this kind of unstable coalition elected the new mayor. And actually he appointed me to become the chief strategy and finance. Well, at first I was only chief strategy officer, last 3 years chief strategy and finance officer of the waterfront, and we launched a strategy to take advantage of that infrastructure, to bring back the public space to the people using lighter, quicker, cheaper experiments, engagement projects and so on, refurbish some buildings, creating the innovation district of the city. And now, after 4 years, it's already the second most visited public space in town. So it seems that it worked quite a bit.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that you touched on this, but that's always kind of a constant struggle that I'm always thinking about with kind of any big project like that, that kind of focuses on one area of the city and tries to upgrade it or rejuvenate it or whatever word you want to use. So often people who used this place before are excluded from it after the project's kind of done, or are no longer able to access it because it's expensive or just doesn't have that same kind of public feel that you were talking about. So in this project, how did you kind of account for that, and how did you make sure that it was inclusive to everyone who was using it before and everyone who, I guess, couldn't access it before?
That's actually one of our main goals. mm-hmm. starting from the position that we very well know that inclusion is a never-ending goal.
Yeah.
So we must like target specifically maybe some communities and include them somehow. But first of all, we wanted to become an open organization that we weren't. So the most informal part of engagement, which is basically listen and be able to have a conversation and look to the people in the eyes and talk the language to them, that's very, very important. So I remember first year, I had 800 meetings. There were like a couple days a week that I felt like a doctor. It was just 10 minutes in the morning. But it was important to talk to the people. And we always said that the waterfront should become the place where the good stuff happened without defining too much what's the good stuff. We also kind of implement an informal 10-second rules, which means that every time that someone is coming and presents their idea of project, if in 10 seconds we don't come to a reason to say no, because it's illegal or very dangerous or whatever, we have to make it possible.
That's awesome. I love that.
And actually, yeah, it was also a bit of a cue of humility, because we were not curating. We just wanted to be the place where people do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, obviously, we identify certain communities, especially around the neighborhood, that we wanted to work with. So there are a lot of stories, but one of the first decisions that we made when we started working here is that we stopped the privatization of a shed, this big, a big, super beautiful shed from the beginning of the 20th century that was about to become a gourmet market, food market, which made no sense because 500 meters from here, there is the actual fresh food market of the neighborhood.
Right.
And that was probably the place in the waterfront when nobody was coming, or not that many people was coming, it was widely used and widely identified. So people said, okay, this place is called the Tinglado, El Tinglado. So we go to El Tinglado, so we started the privatization. Then we did a project because it was about to collapse the structure, and we didn't have money, and all the engineers were advising us to close it down. But we team up with a group of collective of young architects, and they did a specific fabric structure that was protecting the structure, so we could keep it open. And now, after some time, we got enough money, now it's refurbished and it's widely used, and every NGO in the neighborhood can do their events there for free. But it was important to protect the use that was actually coming. We also refurbished an old pergola, this kind of stage that is, it has do you know what is a pergola? It's just, not rounded, no, it's just these stages that sits in the middle of the park, Parisian style, with a roof, no?
Mm-hmm.
So they were designed to have some concerts. So we invited the neighborhood orchestras as well to play, and music in Valencia is very, very important because we are kind of the New Orleans of Europe, so we have the highest density of musicians.
Oh, amazing.
Highest amount of musicians per 100 inhabitants. So we invited them to come, and I always tell the same story, but for me it was very, very moving. So the first time a neighborhood orchestra was playing, it was the neighborhood orchestra of Nazareth, which is the neighborhood that has been mostly, and in a worse way, hit by the development of the commercial harbor, a neighborhood that didn't benefit at all from
mm-hmm.
the expansion of the ports, all the contrary, because now it is a neighborhood that is totally surrounded by heavy infrastructure and disconnected from the city. But whatever, it was a neighborhood that grew in the 60s. Most of the people living there was working at the shipyards that, by the way, were dismantled in the 90s through the industrialization process. But they were really connected to the old harbor. So at the one point, there is this orchestra playing, and I was just walking around and hear these two old ladies around 90-year-old talking to each other. And one of them told the other, I'm very happy today because the first time that I come back to my harbor in 10 years.
Wow.
And that was really, really moving because the sense of belonging was there. But
yeah.
She had absolutely nothing to do before, because what she could do, going to a club and smoking some shisha, paying a 12 euros gin and tonic or eating low quality paella that she could cook much better, you know. So that was just
That's awesome.
An important symbol. And from that, I don't know, we did a bunch of projects, for instance, that was really, really embedded in the memory of the neighborhood, that in the 90s was possible to swim in the harbor. So we opened a swimming area this summer, last summer. It was fantastic. We did specific work with teenagers. We worked with the Roma community that is very present in the neighborhood. So yeah, it's an incremental and never-ending process.
Yeah.
That's actually amazing. And a great anecdote to share with us to actually remember. Sometimes we, as planners, we kind of forget. We forget about I guess what we say right now. How we, I think it's hard to. It's the word that I want to use is to find the emotions really of a place.
And also the purpose. Like, why are we doing that?
Mm.
Yeah.
Why did we do the development? What was the reason?
What is behind it? And it's pretty interesting. And I guess it's for the people. And it's true. I guess it's you had to feel really, really good after hearing that.
Mm-hmm. It was. I even cried a bit. I must admit.
That's actually amazing. And what's new right now for you?
Yeah, I'm happy to share. So I think after 4 years here working on the waterfront, as I said, having one of the coolest jobs in town. I feel that is the moment to move forward and bring my energy maybe to other places.
Yeah.
I think also it's good to know at what time to leave a public sector job. Mm. So it's good to be in and out somehow. So I'm really aligned with, I feel deeply identified with public sector, but I don't necessarily need to work as a public servant forever.
Yeah.
And I want to do other things. And now I think that especially in this COVID situation, it is very important to reflect what will be the situation after and to reflect on how cities are dealing with that. And actually my goal is to focus in the following month in a platform that we are launching from Placemaking Europe, an organization I'm a member to. So I'm moving now to launching this platform that we are launching from Placemaking Europe, which is called the After COVID.City, which is a global initiative for reclaiming the role of places and people to shape a post-COVID world for the better. So we want to do is to collect what different cities around the globe are doing. So we are launching a global research. We also are launching a European manifesto that is actually trying to achieve this goal.
Mm-hmm.
We need to point out and to say it as loud as possible that the future is a collective construct and we have a say. Mm-hmm. There are no things that are inevitable. And also in the specific situation when there are many opportunities, but also many challenges. So there is this old ghost of surveillance, control, nationalism lurking somewhere and very present. And there are some possible futures that we are already seeing quite close, that those of controls, less human exchange, but the same commercial exchange, going back to business as usual. Because this crisis somehow it's acting both as a mirror as an amplifier, so it's really putting cities in the mirror and showing which are their dysfunctions.
Pretty soon. You mentioned this already, but we'll bring it back. We always kind of finish off by asking for a book recommendation or several book recommendations or whatever recommendation you want to make, really. We're pretty flexible.
No, actually, I said Jane Jacobs, and I know I'm not original. Everyone must read Jane Jacobs, but I highly recommend her works in The Economics of Cities, which is not as read as the book of The Death of Life of American Cities. I really, really, really recommend The Economy of Cities. and Cities: The Wealth of Nations. Both books are extremely good, and also they are big open minders.
Yeah.
Mind openers. Well, but those are extremely good, and also I was a bit dyslexic when I was a kid. And obviously English is not my language, so you imagine how it does turn sometimes. And I've been reading a lot during this quarantine, so I think among the books that I read, I really recommend The Open City by Deju Cole. It's a novel by a Nigerian doctor that works in New York, but it's an extremely good reflection about how a city works, and actually how the cities, because he travels also to his hometown in Nigeria and to Brussels.
Okay.
But this kind of a book about urban explorations and walking, which is something that I walk. So I love stories, so you cannot be a good urban planner without enjoying walking and observing. That's extremely important. So I'd say among my reasons, Open City by Deju Cole, a novel, and then please read Jane Jacobs' works on economics.
Amazing. Thank you so much. This has been so, so fantastic. We're really grateful that you could join us.
Thank you so much, and I enjoyed it a lot. So thank you for the conversation. I'm really happy to keep in touch. So let's please keep in touch.
That was fun.
Yes, that was amazing to have our first international episode.
I hope it's the first of many.
that's the first of many
international interviews. And yeah, in some ways, with everyone kind of going digital at the moment and working on Zoom, people have more time to sit down and talk to some young planners in Melbourne. And so it's in that sense, it's kind of, it opens some doors of who we can talk to and what we can talk about on the podcast.
And it's truly right. It's truly to collaborate.
Mm.
In a way, we can find the time to collaborate. And if that's also, if you're listening and you want to collaborate with us, and that's why we do it.
Yeah.
We're there to help each other. So I really hope you guys enjoyed it.
Check out our website.
Again, check out the website, please.
It's what? PlannersUnderTheInfluence.com.
It's super easy. So we can all go and get it. And that's it. So we're just hopefully going to get some more episodes.
Yeah, definitely.
And we appreciate that you guys are listening.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. Stay safe, everyone.
Yeah, stay safe.
Bye.